There are countless amazing stories from the Old West. But of all the stories, our favorite ones are true.
True.
I'm Bob Bowes-Bell, welcoming you to the second episode of True West Stories, a new podcast from True West Magazine.
True West.
Our first episode brought you the True West story of Wyatt Earp in Tombstone, including the famous so-called gunfight at the OK Corral and its aftermath. If you haven't heard it already, you'll definitely want to check it out. Here's a small taste of that first episode.
I think that Wyatt's whole life focused on trying to become a better man than his father was. And I think to a certain extent he succeeded in that. But it required him to have a grip on this potential for rage that was just bred in the cradle.
The gunfight at the OK Corral, it sounds so dramatic and so amazing. And in many ways it was. In other ways, it wasn't. Really, when you really boil it down, it was a misdemeanor arrest gone awry. But in the history of the West, it looms large.
Josie Marcus Earp is the only reason that we know Wyatt Earp's name. Without her obsession, primarily driven by frontal lobe dementia, really, without that, we wouldn't know these guys. Doc Holliday would have been an obscure dentist who died at 36 of tuberculosis. Wyatt Earp would have been one of the very many part-time policemen who was involved in an officer-involved shooting in the 1880s. Nobody would remember him. If it weren't for Josie, we wouldn't have a story to tell.
The voice you just heard is Mary Doria Russell, author of two acclaimed groundbreaking books in this field. One is called Doc, on the life of Doc Holliday, and the other is called Epitaph, which tells Wyatt's entire story. Both books are historical fiction, but she has a lot to say that hits dead center. In this episode, you'll again hear from both Mary and myself about the final chapters of Wyatt Earp's life, along with his wife Josie, and how Wyatt's famous story came to live on.
The two sources for most of the movies, until very recently, were Walter Noble Burns's Tombstone, which became the basis of many movies about the gunfight, and for Wyatt's character, and later on for the 1950s television program, The Life and Legend of Wyatt Earp, that was all based on Stuart Lake's highly romanticized and pruned authorized biography of Wyatt. So those are the two main sources for film versions of Wyatt Earp.
Wyatt Earp was depositioned in 1924 in an estate case in Los Angeles, and the lawyer's kind of trying to suck up to him. And he's an old man, and the guy knew about his past, and he says, "Now, you were a lawman down there in Tombstone's wild and woolly days. What was that like?" Wyatt Earp's answer, quote, "Not half as bad as L.A. So now, get ready. You're going to hear the True West story of Wyatt Earp in Hollywood.
True.
We all know that Wyatt Earp is famous for the gunfight at the OK Corral. And there have been 35 movies so far and counting on the Wyatt Earp story. Basically, his story in Tombstone, although he spent time in Kansas and Wichita and Dodge City and also in Alaska. And he was what they called a boomer. He would go from town to town and did that all the way up to the end of his life. What most people don't know is that Wyatt Earp was a boomer in Hollywood. He showed up there in the early as 1911. And he had a lot of family in the area. His brother was a sheriff in Colton, California, and they were known in the San Bernardino area. Between the years 1911 and 1929, Wyatt Earp spent his summers in Los Angeles and his winters at his mine out in Vidal, California, right across the river from Parker.
Wyatt and Josie had been out prospecting. It was an old age that went kind of downhill as time went on. Of course, it was no Social Security. He had no pension. Her family was not as well off as she would have liked people to believe. And they ended up in their 50s and 60s doing a lot of prospecting. They were living out of the back of their car or a truck. They would just be out camping, prospecting for anything. Oil, gas, copper, silver, gold, anything they could find. And they would come into towns, and it was the beginning of the movies. And they were fascinated by that. And of course, Wyatt would sit there and say, well, I didn't get that right, and they didn't get that right. And Josie's idea was, we can go to Los Angeles and you'll get hired as a consultant and you can tell them all the things they're doing wrong. So that was the idea. They were going to settle down, they were going to rent a house, and he was going to get paid big bucks to work as a consultant for the movies. That didn't pan out either.
Now, the weird thing about Los Angeles in those days was that Hollywood was an outlaw town. And the reason is that Thomas Edison owned the patent on the movie projector, and you could not show a movie without his permission. And so you had all these entrepreneurs in New York who wanted to show, for example, French films. Sarah Bernhardt, people like that were in them. And he was such a fuddy-duddy and an uptight, wasp, that he wouldn't allow them to show those films. And one of those gentlemen bought the rights to it to show in America for $10,000. And couldn't show it because Edison owned the patent and he controlled the whole thing. So him and a couple of his pards got on a train and they went out west, and legend says they stopped in Flagstaff. They had an idea that they were going to do movies in Flagstaff, Arizona. But it was snow on the ground, and so they said, well, let's take the train all the way to the end of the line. And the end of the line was this sleepy little village called Hollywood, California. Now, the reason they went there was to get as far away from Edison as they could. And they even had all of their sets on wheels so that they could load them on trucks and go to Tijuana and go across the border and escape. And of course, Edison came after them, and one of the gentlemen had, I believe, 250 lawsuits filed against him. They tried to take him down that way, and they couldn't. So Earp is in this town with all these other outlaws, and then it's just a wide open town. They're doing all these movies, quote unquote, illegally, and Earp fits right in. He knows them all. He plays cards with them. He himself is arrested at the Hollenbeck Hotel for an illegal faro game. Zane Grey comes to town, and he sells his first movie rights for $25,000. These are big numbers. This is like 1911, 1912 in that era. And but he's immediately gets the gist of the town, and he has a great quote that I think sums up Hollywood in 1911, and you might say even today. Here's the quote. I will not say that all the people in the motion picture industry are crooks, but I will say that all the crooks in Hollywood are in the motion picture industry.
When Wyatt and Josie got to Hollywood, the industry was not brand new. It was early, but it wasn't brand new. And you had a number of small producers who were making westerns, one and two reel westerns, very quickly. These are people who didn't care that the horses got killed in the stunts. They didn't care that their stunt riders were being crippled. They obviously didn't care about facts. The whole reason they were doing this was to push the product out the door as quickly as possible. So Wyatt shows up, and he's a guy in his 60s. He expected to be treated with some respect. And I think they just thought that he was a pain in the neck who wanted to correct everything they were doing. Oh, you're doing it wrong. Well, try to imagine how little we care. So I think he was humiliated by that. I think that he was perfectly happy to talk to the stunt riders and the wranglers, but I think that he just was of no help at all to the producers. And they didn't want anything to do with him. It was easier for them to simply wait until this old guy died, use his name any way they pleased, and make the movies however they thought it should be done.
So you have this outlaw town, and Wyatt Earp should be able to parlay his story, of all people, into a movie and into a movie career. And he cannot get arrested. And I mean that in the showbiz terminology, because he had been arrested several times throughout his life. He had been arrested for prostitution in Illinois, for horse stealing in Kansas, for burglary in Arkansas, for claim jumping in Idaho, and for attacking a law officer in Alaska, and for bunco steering in Los Angeles. So the guy's got what you might call a rap sheet. And he is seen as a ne'er-do-well. In fact, he cannot go back to Arizona because he's wanted for murder, for killing Frank Stillwell, one of the men who allegedly conspired to kill his brother Morgan in 1882, and he left the state a fugitive. Now, what's weird is that Earp roamed all up and down the Colorado River and flirted with the Arizona side. He was in Yuma, he was in Parker, he was in Needles. He would go there to fleece the soldiers. The soldiers would go on payday and he would play cards with them, and that's how he loved to make his money. So he was flirting. He never went back to Tombstone, though, because he might have been arrested as a fugitive. So here he is. You'd think that his story would be just perfect for Hollywood, but they don't like it, because there was a formula way to make Westerns at that time that we're all familiar with today, is the Tom Mix silence, and also William S. Hart, and those were the big dogs. William S. Anderson was the first cowboy star, and he said he made Westerns like popcorn. He'd write the scripts on his cuff of his shirt, he'd make them in the morning, edit them in the afternoon, and put them out, and he was making $125,000 a year churning out, these Western movies. But the Westerns were not like the Westerns we think of today. You had to rescue an orphan, preferably from a fire, and the love of a good woman, usually a Christian woman, saved the man. So even a good bad man, like William S. Hart was fond of playing, would be saved by the love of a woman. And you've seen those scenes of the guys, you know, with his overacting and clasping his heart and the girl, and the screen goes down to show a happy ending. So they didn't want anything to do with Wyatt Earp. And they were into the third decade of making Westerns until they made the first Wyatt Earp movie. And here's how that happened. In the 1900s, the two biggest stars in Hollywood, at least for Westerns, were Tom Mix and William S. Hart. And they both were very rich from making these movies. Tom Mix was making $10,000 a week without income tax taken out. Think about that. That is just incredible. He had a palatial mansion where he threw lavish parties. There's no evidence that Earp actually attended those, but Tom idolized Wyatt Earp, and he thought that they both should get culture, because they would go places in Los Angeles and they would be put down as those hokey cowboys. And so Tom Mix got the idea that they were going to read Shakespeare. And so he got some books and delivered it, the volume, to Wyatt. And Wyatt famously commented, quote, "That feller Hamlet was a talkative man. He wouldn't have lasted long in Kansas," end of quote.
I don't know if he ever appeared in a movie. Remember that at the time, you know, they're making the movies, Wyatt's in his mid-60s, going on 70s. You know, this is not a character that is going to be in the middle of these shoot-em-ups. And so he might have been in the background once or twice, I really don't know. He did become friends with Tom Mix, and William S. Hart kind of took him under his wing.
William S. Hart and Tom Mix both gravitated to him, probably looked him up, just because they were fans of the real West and they came out of that world. The modern thing would be as if you had a Bruce Willis or somebody that was an A-list star today, and they heard that there was this guy who actually walked the walk, and they would look him up and say, "Hey, I really admire you." And that's what happened with Tom Mix and William S. Hart. They sought him out, they admired him, and they would take him to lunch, and they would go to Musso and Frank's and hang out.
But William S. Hart was already way past his peak. He had been the world's first international movie star. And Wyatt was a big fan. Tom Mix, he thought, you know, the costumes were kind of dumb and the stunts were weird. And Josie thought that was funny. But he was off set. He was talking to the guys in the background. And I don't think that he ever really made connections with people who were making decisions in Hollywood. To this day, it's very difficult to get to that level. And they were really not interested in talking to this old guy.
So Tom Mix never asked Wyatt Earp to be in his movies or to even ask him how the West was, because in his mind, there was a world of difference between what really happened in the West and Westerns that were being made. They were totally fantasy, and they were a totally different animal. William S. Hart, however, he tried to make a Western that was more authentic, and it's the last movie, or one of the last movies that he made. and was on the life of Wild Bill Hickok. And Wyatt Earp was credited with being a consultant on that film. And Josie Earp went and saw the movie twice and wrote a letter to him and said, oh, I can't wait until you do the movie on Wyatt. And Hart said, well, you need to publish a book first and then I'll be able to do it. But that movie bombed. And the soldiers had come back from World War I. They were tired of the hokey stuff. They'd been in Europe. They wanted something more sophisticated. And so William S. Hart's career was over. And this is like 1924, 1925. And so Earp and his wife, Josephine, especially Josephine, wanted to cash in. They were older. There was no Social Security, as I mentioned. And she needed some money. And so she really hammered Wyatt to tell the old stories. There was one problem. She did not want, under any circumstance, her name mentioned in the stories.
I think one of the reasons that Wyatt's story was never told by him to Hollywood was because he and his wife really wanted to keep control of the story. They wanted it to be their version of what happened.
She had been in Tombstone at the time of the famous events there, but she was the girlfriend of Wyatt's nemesis, Sheriff John Behan. And there is a mention of her in the newspaper that says, Mrs. Behan arrived on the stage today. Well, A, they weren't married, and B, she was mortified that she was identified. This has led a lot of people to believe that she perchance was even on the line. And on the line is a euphemism for being on the line for prostitution. All the prostitution houses were put in one section of town so they could be policed, and they were all put in a row, conversely, on the line.
So she got to Tombstone, and by that point was an experienced girl. I think that it's accurate to say that she liked men. I think that it's accurate to note that there was a interregnum between when she was living with John Behan and when she was living with Wyatt. I believe that she saw herself as the Lady of the Camellias. She had gentlemen callers whom she sometimes entertained, and she was given gifts. And sometimes the gifts were in cash. I think that it's unfair to call her a prostitute. I also think that you should point out that prostitution was legal at this time, and as was alcohol and gambling. By the time she was telling her story to people, those things were illegal and scandalous. And I think that it's not unlikely that she was a little coy about her story.
The fact that she would not talk about this has led many people to speculate the worst. If she just would have told the truth, perhaps she was mortified that they just were shacking up. But at any rate, she wanted to tell Wyatt's story and cash in. But at the same time, she was just crazy about not mentioning her. And she did this to the moment she died. She lived until 1944. And a couple things happened that are heartbreaking. Wyatt Earp, for the life that he lived, and the fact that there are 35 movies so far based on his life, never made a dime from his story. The outlaws who run Hollywood did. But she, on the other hand, outlived Wyatt by about 15 years. And she made a deal with the writer. But we need to back up just a little bit to get how that happened. Doroteo Arango was the dude's name, and he was an outlaw. Actually, he had a butcher shop in Durango, Mexico, and he went out and rustled cattle to get product. And then later, fast forward maybe 20 years, he has a different name, Pancho Villa, and he's a general in the army, and he basically does kind of what he did as an outlaw, only under the guise of nation building. Usurping other people's ranches for the cause. He gets into a big fight south of Douglas, Arizona, on the Mexican side is Agua Prieta. And this is 1916, so we have some modern warfare things in place. We have airplanes, We have machine guns, and the death toll is through the roof. 1.5 million Mexicans lost their life in that revolution. That's more than all the wars the United States has fought. All the wars, Civil War, Revolutionary War, Korea, World War I, World War II, do not add up to 1.5 million. That's how many people died, mowed down usually by machine guns. And this is that period when people were still trying to fight wars with cavalry, and they just hadn't got the memo that it ain't gonna work. So Doroteo Arango shows up at Agua Prieta for a big fight, and he's tricked. He has 15,000 men, and as they get ready to charge, Klieg lights come on in the night, and his men are mowed down with modern warfare. 5,000 of his men surrender to the other side. He leaves with his tail between his legs. There was almost a mutiny, and people wanted to get him. And he's on his way back to Chihuahua, the state, when he's south of the present-day town of Columbus, New Mexico. And he's so mad at the United States because he feels that the other side were using the railroads on the U.S. side of the border to transport troops and weapons to fight him. And so he broke a cardinal rule, which was he attacked the United States. He came across in Columbus, New Mexico, and in a firefight killed, I believe, 11 men, soldiers, and burnt the town. This was a huge story, as you can imagine. It wasn't until 9/11 that it happened again. But America was attacked, and a sports writer in Chicago got the assignment to go to Columbus, New Mexico to cover this story for his newspaper. He arrives there, he interviews some people, and then to cover the story further, he goes down the line to El Paso, which is east of Columbus. And while he's there, he wants to get a beer, and so he goes into the Coney Island Saloon, and he's talking to the owner, Tom Powers, and he asks, "What's that gun over the bar?" And Tom Powers said, "That's the gun that killed Billy the Kid, Pat Garrett's gun. They used to be partners." He files that away, the sports writer, in his mind. He goes back to Chicago, files his story, and he has a sister that's living in Albuquerque. And so he goes to Albuquerque to visit her, and he borrows a car and drives out to Fort Sumner, New Mexico, to visit the Billy the Kid Museum, which costs a quarter to get in, and no one may get like five people a year, because Billy the Kid has been forgotten. He is this regional character that kind of had a blip back in the 1880s and has long been forgotten. So Walter Noble Burns writes a book that ends up to be the first Book of the Month Club book called The Saga of Billy the Kid. And the first words of that book are, "John Chisholm knew cows." End of quote. Billy the Kid doesn't show up to page 13, but the book resurrects Billy the Kid and makes him a national, I mean international, hero. And he is featured in 60 movies. There's been 60 movies about Billy the Kid. So Walter Noble Burns hit a home run. And his publisher says, "What else you got?" And he said, "You know, I've got an idea to do something on Tombstone." And they said, "Well, you should go talk to Wyatt Earp, because he's living in Los Angeles now." And so he did. And when he knocked on Wyatt's door, he had one big problem. Wyatt Earp was already trying to write his story and cash in with John Flood Jr. And so he felt obligated to be loyal to John Flood. And he said, "I'm sorry, I can't tell you my story. I'm already committed."
John Flood was introduced to the Earps after they had settled in Los Angeles. And Wyatt kind of got into trouble almost immediately. He was still running faro games to make a stake at the beginning of their stay in any new town. Well, by the time they were in Los Angeles, faro was considered a bunco game, not without some reality. And he was arrested for running this, and they were late on their rent, and so Josie went to the landlady and pleaded for time. You know, like, I think I could get the money from my sister. And at that point, the landlady introduced them to their neighbor, a young man named John Flood. Well, he wasn't that young. He was in his middle 30s. He was a mining engineer who had gone to Yale. He had also been orphaned when he was quite young. He lost his whole family in rapid succession when he was in his early teens. I think John was looking for family. And I think the Earps were looking for the child that they never had. John, I think, was just, it was thrilling for him to be enveloped in Josie's hospitality. She was quite maternal at this point, you know. She was kind of dumpy, but she was a great baker. And, you know, she would eat, you know, have some pastry. And they kind of adopted one another. At first, he was simply helping them with things they didn't understand. The electricity and the rules about gambling. Later on, he helped them find a dentist. Wyatt had terrible teeth. He helped them with taxes. They didn't understand about income taxes. He really endeared himself to the Earps by suggesting that they sell the rights to a well that they had to her sister. Her sister had some money, and she then paid them royalties for the rest of their lives. That was the first steady income that they had. So after that, John Flood could do no wrong. He really was their savior in many ways. He was an engineer, okay? If engineers wanted to be English majors, they would have been. John was literate, and he could write a letter for them. Often Josie was involved with writing letters to newspapers that she felt had been misportraying her husband. But there's a long way from what John was able to write, which was straightforward, factual renditions of things, to writing an account of the gunfight at the OK Corral. This was Josie's idea. Her notion was that Wyatt was going to tell John the real story, and John was going to write it all down, and then they were going to provide it to William S. Hart, and he was going to produce a movie that would be like a documentary that would get everything correct.
Now, what you need to know is that John Flood was a really nice man, but a terrible writer. The story that they were writing together was absolutely unpublishable. They sent it to Saturday Evening Post. They sent it to all kinds of people. William S. Hart tried to put in a good word for it, and it was just a piece of junk.
John did his best. But every time she'd overhear Wyatt telling something that was a little iffy, she would tell John, you can't write that. You have to change that. She kept telling him, it has to be a clean story. It has to have more pep. He didn't know what she was talking about. What was pep? She just nagged at him until he would write it the way she thought that it should be written. It took years because she kept changing things and asking him to rewrite things and adding more. And by the time it was done, it was unreadable. It was just awful. And it was turned down by something like 30 different publishers. And it has been published in TypeScript, and it's almost impossible to get through.
To give you a clue how bad that was, on the OK Corral fight, John Flood thought, that you had to use the word crack, C-R-A-C-K, exclamation point, in capital letters. Someone had told him, perhaps Tom Mix or some writer at the studio, that people like to read the word crack at a Western. So in the OK Corral fight, there are 237 cracks, and they just follow each other. You go all the way down the page, it goes crack, 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 crack. And then you turn it, and then Wyatt Earp says, our guns became so hot we couldn't hold the barrel. The barrel was so hot we had to put our guns down. And so this is just bad writing, and Wyatt Earp's telling the story, allegedly.
But if you understand the circumstances under which he was writing, you just feel sorry for John Flood. It's not his bad writing, it's the horrendous editing that Josie insisted on. I don't know how much Wyatt was aware of the changes that Josie was insisting on. He would sit there and he'd tell his version of the story, and poor John would be taking notes on what was going on. And then Josie would say, John, come and help me with something in the kitchen. Or she would walk him out of their little house and down the sidewalk and say, you can't write that. You just can't write that. And she would suggest changes to him. And then she would check to see if he was doing the changes. So I don't know how much Wyatt was aware of how terrible this thing was becoming and how convoluted the story was becoming and how many blind alleys she was leading John Flood into. It's hard to tell. We don't really have a lot of documentation of that element of the story, but you can certainly read his manuscript and understand how badly snarled it was becoming.
So they really need Walter Noble Burns, but they cannot commit to him. So what does Walter do? He pulls a trick that writers have pulled for years. He said, would you help me with a book on Doc Holliday? And White says, well, I'll do that. And so he comes out with the book Tombstone, and the star of Tombstone is the Lion of Tombstone. It's an entire chapter, and the book is a huge success.
Tombstone, an Iliad of the West, and that was published in 1927. Enormous bestseller. Wyatt was under the impression that Walter Noble Burns was actually writing a story about Doc Holliday. Well, Burns didn't mention to him that he was actually writing about the gunfight. And it was written and published before you had to identify a book as a novel on the cover. And a lot of people took this to be real history. So suddenly, because it was told as a hero, you know, the lawman versus the cattle rustlers, a considerable simplification of the story, people thought that that was the truth, and Wyatt comes off as the hero of the story. Suddenly, he was the Lion of Tombstone. He was a man that you could admire and name your sons after.
Walter Noble Burns' book, Tombstone, is a classic. And it was even more successful than the Billy the Kid book. And so Wyatt Earp's story now had heated up.
Josie became just obsessed with getting this story told. She was also very, very concerned about the fact that she had no income, apart from the royalties on their one producing well that had come through and that her sister was paying on. She was very, very concerned that everybody was making money off of Wyatt's story except for them. And so at the very end of Wyatt's life, the last 6 months of his life, when he was quite ill, Stuart Lake approached them about doing an authorized biography.
But who was it that piqued Stuart Lake's interest in Wyatt Earp? The answer is none other than Bat Masterson.
At the time that the Earps were in Los Angeles, Bat Masterson had settled in New York City and had been there for quite a long time. And Bat, he was a storyteller. And he got the best job of his life working for a New York newspaper covering prize fights and horse races. And his ability to spin a tale was finally recognized for what it was, which was great entertainment. Bat comes out of a storytelling tradition that includes Mark Twain and includes the tradition of starting a story with a certain amount of reality and then spinning it out further and further and further, making it more and more absurd, just to see how far you could tell it before the tenderfoot tumbled to the fact that you're lying. The whole thing is, you know, you've gotten way deep into fantasy at the end of the story. So Bat's interesting because he is the source of almost every scurrilous rumor about John Henry Holliday. Most of our understanding of Doc Holliday comes from a very fanciful magazine article that Bat wrote about him. And with an enormous lack of interest in the facts, he also lionized Wyatt Earp.
And so Stuart Lake was a press secretary for Teddy Roosevelt. And he was at the White House, and Teddy liked to have Westerners come to the White House. Pat Garrett visited the White House, Geronimo rode in his parade. Bat Masterson visited several times, and Stuart Lake overheard Bat Masterson say that the true story of the West will never be told until Wyatt Earp talks, and he's not talking. And then Bat Masterson went back to New York, was writing a column at the newspaper, he was a sports writer, died at his desk, and Stuart Lake thought, you know what, I need to go find this guy. So he goes after Burns and shows up at Wyatt Earp's doorstep. And by then, they knew that the flood version of Wyatt's life was not going to sell. And so she, Josephine Earp, cuts a deal with Stuart Lake. And they will split half of any of the proceeds that come out of their project together.
He came to see Wyatt once or twice at the end. And Wyatt at this point was in a great deal of discomfort. And Wyatt was never a big talker. So it was just literally pulling teeth to get him to tell the story.
He had basically three responses, and the one was yep, and one was nope, and the other one was don't recall. So he was a terrible interview. Walter Noble Burns talked about it. Stuart Lake talked about it. He said he practically had to invent quotes because he was so taciturn and he wouldn't talk.
So the last 4 or 5 months, Stuart Lake would write to Josie, and she would answer the questions for him. So now we're not getting Wyatt's story anymore. And I don't think that Wyatt was checking her facts at all. I think she was just answering the letters.
And so Stuart Lake interviews Wyatt Earp a couple times, not very many times, and then Wyatt dies himself. His last words are, suppose, suppose. Haunting.
Wyatt died early in 1929. And at that point, it's just before the crash. Josie has very little income, but Stuart Lake has promised to split all of the royalties on his book with her 50-50. When the crash comes in October of 29, she totally panicked and made his life a misery, constantly asking him for changes. And I think he really regretted making this arrangement with him. He was a man of goodwill and he was a man of his word. He was an honorable man who really did split his royalties with her to the end of her life in 1944. But she didn't make it easy for him. And so I think very little of Wyatt's story gets into Stuart Lake's authorized biography. And I think that Josie is the main source for almost everything that comes out of it. 4 years later, Stuart Lake published an authorized biography of Wyatt. This was minutely supervised by Wyatt's widow, Josephine Marcus Earp, who herself had a rather casual relationship with the truth. This whole story, she made sure that it was pruned and polished and shaped until Wyatt became really the flawless lawman of the lawless West. He was like Elliot Ness fighting the Al Capone gang in Chicago. You gotta remember when this was being written, it's 1930s, it's Prohibition. So people tied in what happened in Tombstone to what was happening in Chicago. And they saw him as Elliot Ness, as an incorruptible, untouchable lawman.
And that sets the stage for Wyatt to be finally recognized and to be a movie story. But one more thing has to happen, and you're not going to believe it. Now, there's another problem that's happening in the movies. At the late 20s, gangster movies were all the go. Public Enemy number one, and here's what happened. The Hays Code, which is this very powerful moral committee, they would go to the Hollywood studios and go, you can't do that. We're going to give you a bad rating, and you can't make that movie. It's immoral, it's too violent, etc. They wielded a lot of power. And the Hays Code people went to the Hollywood studios and said, no, stop making those gangster movies. And so Hollywood, the powers that be, said, okay. And then when they left, they said, I wonder how that would work in a Western. And once that happened, once you put Wyatt Earp and his brothers and Doc Holliday walking down that street with a shotgun and their guns, aiming off against four outlaws, a la the Valentine's Day Massacre, now you have a new kind of Western. And that is the moment that the Wyatt Earp story was born. And that was in 1931. And there have been 35 movies since then that all tell this story. And most people don't know that for the first 30 years of Westerns in Hollywood, there was no Wyatt Earp story.
They finally began to do these films in the late 30s and 40s. So at that point, Wyatt's long dead. You don't have to pay him royalties for his story. You don't have to get anything right because he's not there to carp about the details. Towards the end of her life, Josie began to suffer from what we now know as frontal lobe dementia. By that time, Josie was so far into dementia that she was no longer able to argue with anybody or sue them over the story. She died in 1944 during the Battle of the Bulge. And at that point, all bets were off. You could do anything you wanted with the story.
So what kind of a job did Hollywood actually do in telling Wyatt's story?
Of all of the stories, of all of the movies that were made about the gunfight at the OK Corral, I think My Darling Clementine has the least to do with history as it actually occurred. About the only thing that's correct in that movie are the names, okay, which are sort of randomly distributed to the actors. So you've got Ward Bond, you know, playing Warren, who was the youngest of the brothers, and James is supposed to be the youngest, and he's the one who gets, it's just wrong. Doc Holliday is turned into, instead of a dental surgeon from Georgia, he is a physician from Boston. He's got a girlfriend named Chihuahua. I mean, it's just bizarre.
John Ford, who eventually did My Darling Clementine, about the Wyatt Earp story, said that Wyatt Earp told him on the set how the OK Corral actually went down. And that's kind of hard to believe, because if you've seen My Darling Clementine in the actual fight, it's not really very accurate. But that's the legend. John Ford claims Wyatt Earp told him.
The gunfight itself, I think, bears no resemblance to what actually happened. We have an awful lot of court testimony. You're talking about 30 seconds. Nobody saw the whole thing. The gun smoke really was so heavy that it was impossible. Nobody had a vantage point where they could see the entire fight, including the people who were involved in it. So I have to say that My Darling Clementine is my least favorite of all of the portrayals of the history.
So how much of Wyatt actually gets into the movies of today? How much is Josie? How much is Wyatt?
The Hollywood people who have tried to tell the story of Wyatt Earp later, the most recent movies, tend to take more care with trying to get things right. Certainly Tombstone, I think, is the best of the films. I do think that Kurt Russell's portrayal of Wyatt Earp might be closer to what Morgan Earp was really like. It's quite charming. I don't like Kevin Costner's film Wyatt Earp as well, but I think that he might have come closer to the coldness and the emotional distance of the man than anybody else. Wyatt had a great deal of his psychological and emotional energy involved in control of his emotions. And I think that when you are trying to channel very narrowly everything that you've got inside you, it becomes necessary to shut everything down. And Kevin Costner was quite good at portraying that kind of control.
So, after all of her efforts, how would Josie feel about the way Hollywood has ultimately portrayed her husband?
I feel quite sure that Josie wouldn't have liked any of the movies. I think that she would have loved the television program, The Life and Legend of Wyatt Earp, which I think is, you know, that's truth in advertising. There's a lot of legend involved with that one. I think she would be thrilled with that. He dressed well, you know, he looked good, and he never did anything bad. But I think of the movies, I don't know how Wyatt would have felt about it.
Wyatt Earp was really not that interested in telling a story. In fact, he hated to talk about it.
I don't think that Wyatt really wanted the movie. I think that it was his wife, Josie, who was the push behind all of that. And she very, very much wanted her husband to be remembered as a flawless lawman of the lawless West. And that was a considerable simplification of her husband's story. And so, her feeling was that any element of a story that anybody else told that didn't rise to that level of heroism was wrong and evil and suitable for a lawsuit.
Wyatt Earp was burned by the media over and over again. I mean, he was constantly being portrayed as a bad man, and there were all sorts of reports that he had done some nefarious deed, and he often would go to the newspaper and confront the people and say, I wanted a retraction. He did that in Los Angeles, actually. And they got a retraction, but nonetheless, the stories kept being repeated.
And so Josie was the one who was really pushing him to tell his story and get it told right. I don't think Wyatt wanted to talk about it. Very few people who have been through firefights, who have been through the kinds of trauma that come from a fight like the gunfight at the OK Corral, and the aftermath of the vendetta, and losing a brother who dies in your arms. Very few people want to talk about that. And Josie just would not let up on him. So I think he was reluctant from start to finish.
Well, I think one of the saddest things about the story is that Wyatt didn't live to see that he would become this legend. At the time of his death, Pat Masterson was probably three times as famous as Wyatt Earp was. But within the next 10 years, 15 years for sure, certainly today, Wyatt Earp is 10 times bigger than Bat Masterson or almost anyone else, with the possible exception of Billy the Kid, Jesse James, and Custer. And Wyatt Earp shoulder to shoulder with those guys, and it's so ironic because when he was alive, he was not known.
True.
The True West Stories podcast is a production of Worldwide Radio and True West Magazine, The History of the American Frontier. This episode was produced and edited by Paul Fay and engineered by Laurent Jovan, Daniel Stewart, and Bill Schulenberg. The theme music was created by Paul Fay and Nathan Fay, with additional assistance from Michael Cuneo at Never Never Music. Our executive producer is Ken Morisano. To subscribe to this podcast and find additional bonus content, visit our website at truewestmagazine.com.
True West.
There, you can also find my books, including The Illustrated Life and Times of Wyatt Earp. If you enjoy our podcast, please share it with your friends. To find out more, follow True West Magazine on Facebook and on Twitter at True West Mag. I'm Bob Bowes-Bell, inviting you to join us again for the next upcoming episode of the True West Stories podcast.
True.
Podcast by
Worldwide Radio.